The US government has issued TikTok with an ultimatum: sell up or ship out. But will they be able to make good on their threat? For that and everything else worth talking about, find and follow Newsable wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hi, I'm Michael Wright, and welcome to The Long Read from Stuff. This week's story is from Stuff's Auckland newsroom and is called The King's Arms. It's written by senior journalist Steve Kilgallen, who joins me now. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Michael.
So for anyone who doesn't know, first up, what is The King's Arms?
Well, what was The King's Arms, I suppose? It was one of those classic old school inner city pubs of the sort you don't see very many of anymore. And it was a place that I would occasionally go for a beer, particularly on their Wednesday evening quiz nights.
Story for another time. But what is significant about the King's Arms? It was famously a music venue, wasn't it?
Yeah, if you're into music, then you probably would have heard of the King's Arms. It filled that gap between the really small venue and the really big stadium venue. So they got a lot of bands on the way up coming through. The White Stripes famously played there when they were sort of just emerging. And it was in Newton, a sort of inner city suburb of Auckland, for people who don't know Auckland, which was traditionally been a very working class area until the motorway came through and took out a lot of the housing. It was one of the oldest pubs in Auckland. It'd been there a long time. And it had been in the same family for about 50 years, the Gordon family. And they made the decision to build it up into a music pub, partly because of the decline of the traditional inner city boozer. And they'd made a real go at it. But in the end, the value of the land just got far too much for the value of the pub. And so the story is really about the last days of a iconic pub, and a little bit more, I guess, about what that means in general for the changes in society and the changes in the way we drink and socialise, and how it affected this one really well-loved pub, certainly by a lot of people, including me.
So the story is sort of a eulogy, I guess, in that sense, given that the pub is no more. Has anything replaced it, or does anything exist in this space? Where do those young, up-and-coming indie bands play now?
I think it has left a bit of a hole. There have been a few venues spring up. Yeah, every time I drive through Central Auckland, I see the big apartment building that's gone in to replace it. And it looks very nice, and the guy who built it was a guy who used to drink at the King's Arms. So, you know, he had some sympathy for what he's replacing, but it's always struck me as quite sad that we've got a lot of these apartment buildings, but we haven't got a lot of places like the King's Arms was. As an assignment, it was a lot of fun, really. I spent the last 2 weeks of this pub hanging out at the pub, really, talking to people who work there and the regulars.
Intensely researching.
And I went in for a beer on the very last day, actually. And there were all these people dropping in who'd not been there for years. It was quite a weird... So it did feel like a eulogy.
A wake so it was, before.
It was. So it was a fun story to write.
All right, let's hear it. Here is Elmo Johnston reading Steve's story, The King's Arms.
The beginning of the end was not when bands began advertising their farewell gigs at the venue, because those began a whole 15 months before the doors were actually due to close. It was when things began disappearing. The sign for the ladies' toilets, somehow mysteriously the Rhinek clock from behind the public bar, the illuminated picture of a king's head which hung outside. It was the souvenir hunters that officially marked the last days of the King's Arms pub. Co-owner Maria Sheridan was sick of people going on about it being their pub. It wasn't. The pub's manager, Peter Burney, was sick of the grief tourists who did a lap of the bar and never bought a pint. They'll come in, they'll have a walk around, ask, "Can I have this?" and they walk out. "They've done us no favours. That's why we're closing, guys. All you had to do was come in and buy a frickin' beer." The King's Arms finally shut on February 28, 2018, after 198 years on the same site in the Auckland suburb of Newton. When the bulldozers roll in, they will demolish not only one of New Zealand's last remaining old-school big inner-city boozers, but also one of its most important live music venues. The tale of the King's Arms is actually a few different stories. It's how we've changed the way we drink. It's how we've changed how we listen to music. But it's also the story of Maureen Gordon, who for 35 years ran this pub with complete command. The television news once called her the rock and roll granny. On her watch, the King's Arms became a hub of the metal, punk, indie and reggae scenes. The irony was, Maureen, who was 86 when she died, was a classically trained singer who would often leave after the band's sound checks to go to an orchestral concert. But music proved to be a way to keep alive an old-fashioned pub whose core clientele were literally dying off. An aerial photo from the 1940s shows the King's Arms sat squarely in a busy grid of workers' cottages. Newton was then a working-class area, described by The Truth in 1926 as the haunt of many of Auckland's best-known crooks. Every one of them is known by the local CID. The pub, built in 1880, was then a traditional weatherboard street corner affair, with a lantern-lit gable end and a cursive sign bearing the name of Arthur Robert Hardy, one of the earliest licensees. But in 1965, the Northwestern Motorway shoved through the bottom of the gully below, taking 14,000 homes with it and leaving the pub no longer parked on a corner, but down a dead end. Artist John Radford, who once built a series of miniatures of those lost homes, observed, "They knocked down almost a whole suburb," and talked of standing on the nearby Karangahape Road overbridge and feeling an overwhelming feeling of desolation. If you were kind, it made the King's Arms a destination venue. When the venue's music promoter, Maureen's daughter Lisa Gordon, first began making posters to advertise gigs, she had to include a little map, because nobody knew where they were. In 1983, when Maureen and her husband Peter Gordon bought the King's Arms lease with assistance from Lion Breweries, it was a tough pub with a gang element which needed tidying up. And Peter did just that. As each of the five Gordon children, Susan, Michael, Simon, Maria, now Sheridan, and Lisa, came of age, they were pressed into service. Maria remembers at 19 her dad giving her shifts in the pub's sports bar, a busy tap room with pokies, a TAB, and heavy drinking tradesmen. "I wasn't all that keen. He brought me in here and I just looked around and thought, you've got to be kidding." "It would be packed," says Lisa of her first spell working in there. "You would walk around in a haze of smoke. It was real old school, but it was party night every night in there." Maureen had been raised in hospitality. Her parents owned a small hotel nearby, but was trained as a singer after nuns at St Mary's Catholic School recognised her vocal talent. She won the New Zealand ARIA Award and then a scholarship to study in London. She'd already met Peter by then, probably at a local dance hall, but he waited for her. They married after she returned and went into the pub trade. The Jolly Farmers at Drury, the now-demolished Carpenter's Arms in the city, the Nepean in Western Sydney, and even an ice cream parlour before the King's Arms that prevailed. But Peter died the year they bought the building outright, 1993, leaving his wife to run the pub alone. What was she like? "Tough," says the pub's longest-serving staff member, Yvonne Bald. "Tough," says music promoter John Baker. "Tough," said the man she sold it to, Kelly McEwen. She had to be, as a woman presiding over a male-dominated barroom. Also, immaculately dressed, graceful, loved a chat, knew the business, knew the punters, such as the now septuagenarian dominatrix who came in her working clothes for a court and a chat and to try and persuade Maureen to go out drinking with her.
Today on Usable, the clock is ticking for TikTok after the US government gave the social media giant a deadline to sell their US operations. But do they have the power to actually follow through? Plus, the property market is stagnating along with the rest of the economy. And you can't say we didn't warn you, Cicadageddon is upon us in the United States and things are getting weird. For everything that's worth talking about, find and follow Usable wherever you get your podcasts.
Jack White, singer, guitarist, and a relatively unknown Detroit two-piece called The White Stripes, was in Cleveland, Ohio, when he took a call from a New Zealander named John Baker. It was early 2000, and Baker wanted the band to tour here. When White hung up, he was asked who was on the phone. "Some guy from New Zealand," he said with incredulity. Baker sent him the air tickets, and White rang back. So Baker was serious after all. The White Stripes would play two nights at the King's Arms as part of a five-date tour of New Zealand, and by the end of it, Baker had become their road manager. So he was there to witness firsthand the UK realising 12 months later what New Zealand had already worked out. There to see the band play Glastonbury and Reading and Leeds festivals and become a big deal. The White Stripes gig at the King's Arms has become pretty famous, but a host of other name acts have passed through those doors. The Drifters, Lloyd Cole, The Misfits, The National. Matt Strubent from Rock and Roll Machine jumped off the PA during a guitar solo and broke his leg. There was a mid-gig speaker fire thanks to a screaming D4 guitar solo, the band playing on as someone hosed it down. With no real backstage, the Drifters jogged to and from the car park for their encore, then got stuck into drinking with the locals. One promoter slit his wrists because his girlfriend had dumped him. Two radio DJs got married, with Blam 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 playing in support. Di Henwood's band Meatbix played with raw meat strapped to them. Baker promoted a two-day stop by Japanese band Guitar Wolf and got a noise warning on the first night. Pocketed it, forgot about it, and had noise control shut down the second gig. He paid off the band on stage at Ponsonby Bar Java Jive, and the band and the audience walked down the road and resumed the gig. Even the toilets have their stories. The graffiti in the ladies reads, "I've got the heart of a lion and a lifetime ban from the zoo." The music began back in the late 1980s with a country singer called Al Hunter, who played twice a week, including Saturday afternoons, to a raucous crowd in an otherwise deserted lounge bar. "They'd be pissed as chooks," says Tim Weary. Weary was back from almost making it big with a couple of country bands in Sydney and became an enthusiastic regular at Hunter's gigs. When the Glue Pot in Ponsonby closed, costing his band the Waltons their residency there, they moved over and took on Friday nights. They've also played a Christmas party at the pub for the last 24 years. That two-pronged music lineup might have been it, except that Maureen's youngest daughter Lisa, who had left home early to work in record stores in Sydney and London, came home with remarkably diverse music tastes and formed her own band. Weary persuaded her mother to let Gaunt Pudding play, borrowing his PA. Maureen said, "Oh God, have you heard them? And I remember it like it was yesterday, saying, what you might think is rubbish, the young people might like, and if you give it a go, you might be surprised." And then Lisa began booking other bands. It was in the mid-90s, and a lot of older venues, including the Glue Pot, had closed. There was a definite gap in the market. At first, the bookings were local acts, but then came promoters such as Baker, who began bringing overseas artists, in his case, mainly Japanese guitar bands. Stephen Shaw, editor of the music history website Audio Culture, played in several bands that performed at the King's Arms and has been going to gigs there since the Hunter days. The King's Arms became important for the indie, metal, reggae, and punk scenes, he says. They had a unique, fairly organic situation on their hands, and they went with it, says Shaw. The sports bar's decline had begun, and instead music became the meal ticket at the King's Arms. Baker reckons Maureen, rightly loyal to her regulars, worried that the music might upset them and would persuade promoters to let them wander from the sports bar into the music bar for a look. But, says Lisa, there were rarely objections. Except once, when a punter came in when one band was playing rather loudly and unplugged them. She was secretly rather grateful. One of the locals, we used to call him Wobbly Wayne because he was always wobbling after he'd had a few drinks, he'd be in his stubbies and his jandals and be dancing away, and I think the bands had never seen anything like it. But Maureen also stood up to those who didn't want the music in this gentrifying corner of town. When the noise complaints started coming in, she put shipping containers in the car park to dull the sound, then built a $40,000 bespoke noise wall. "I used to feel sorry for Mum," says Lisa. "The phone would ring and people would say, 'What band is playing tonight?' And we'd have a band called The Sore Cocks and she'd have to mutter these names." So the King's Arms became a pub with something of a split personality. Take a typical Tuesday night in late January, a month before the final closure. A queue of well-mannered goths waited patiently to see Norwegian black metal band Mayhem perform. The queue snaked past the plate glass window of the sports bar, where the quiz regulars answered questions about Billy T. James, James Bond, and Sex and the City. To take the stage, the band, wearing corpse-white face paint, black robes, stoles and crosses on chains, had walked down from the green room upstairs, a dirty lounge with carpet worn bare and an old beer box propping open the window. "Charming," said promoter John Baker. "A pain in the arse, more like." Then they strode through the main bar into the pub office, adorned with posters and mugshots of band patrons, and stood in a windowless chipboard passageway waiting for their introduction. The rest of the band went on first, leaving lead singer Attila Kassar pacing beside a pile of lion red swapper crates and the support band's collection of goat skulls. Bernie, manning the door, stood pulling faces at the incongruity. Promoter Ben Mulchin later explained it wasn't the original lineup. He'd bought the ones who hadn't committed suicide, burned down churches, or murdered each other. In the sports bar next door, Maria Sheridan was panicking a little. The pub quiz had four Tuesdays left, and quiz host Brendan Lockheed had yet to find a new venue, and thus a guaranteed weekly escape from their teenagers for her team, the depressed parents. Lockheed had been busy. His business partner was in a coma, his administrator on a long holiday. He'd run this particular quiz for a decade. Maria's husband Liam and her brother Simon were his predecessors. But also, there was nowhere like the King's Arms. "Dead right," he said with the authority of someone who tours the nation's pubs annually for professional purposes. "There's not many old school taverns left, and not many with this history." Why was that? Bruce Robertson, longtime chief executive of Hospitality New Zealand, was blunt. "It's sad, but it's simply a sign of the times. It's a matter of straight economics. Modern venues are smaller, more intimate." He couldn't think of any with the sprawling footprint of the King's Arms, which has two bars, a large beer garden, and a 60-space car park. They were driven by food, not booze, and as the falling gig ticket sales would attest, bars were no longer necessarily the home of new music. Thanks, the internet. The market for pubs like this, quart bottles of Lion Red, bar leaners, a TAB and pokies, was declining. And the punters were literally dying off. "For the style of bar it is, there's only a small market," observes manager Peter Burney, who had been in the trade a long time. "There's been a lot of passings of people. That's normal for a place where regulars have been drinking for 20 or 30 years. You see it at all places. But others have got a young crowd to replenish it. We've not got that." Those that remain are well known. Where they sit, what they drink, even what they drink it out of. How to pretend one who can no longer drink beer is still drinking beer when it's really Diet Coke. A list of phone numbers for another who sometimes needs some assistance heading home. But the change in drink drive laws, tradies who once struck contracts over a quart bottle now drinking at home, older punters drinking at RSAs, the loss of the local working class population all contributed. "Newton isn't what it used to look like 25 years ago. It's all angular and shiny now," observes Baker. Even again, the internet is at fault. "People tell their stories online instead of in person. That's my theory," says Yvonne Bald, who has been pouring pints since 1998. It's a weekday afternoon and there's eight punters in the pub, half in high-vis, most drinking Lion Red. The upshot is, most nights now, if there's nothing on, they're closed by 7 p.m. Maureen had turned down plenty of offers for the pub over the years. Developers Urban Collective's own advertising for what will replace the King's Arms, a refined brick-walled timber-floored apartment complex called 59 France, admits they had coveted the site for well over a decade. You sit there in quiet times and look at a map for possibilities, explains developer Kelly McEwen, who used to live locally and once drank at the King's Arms. But the pivotal moment came in early 2016 when Auckland Council, in consultation with Maureen, made the site the focus of a special housing area, allowing fast-track development and a lifting of the height limit from 6 to 8 stories. That boosted the value of the land far beyond what the balance sheet of a struggling pub could sustain. A petition was mounted, although a deal was far from done. Peter Burney recalls fending off worried customers and callers for weeks. But it was not widely known that Maureen, who is now 86 years old, was not well. Her children suspect that played a big role in her eventual decision to put the pub up for sale. "I don't think Mum ever wanted to let go," says Maria. "I never really wanted to sell either, but I could see why. It's a really tough business." There were 69 tenders lodged. She rejected the 63 that relied on borrowing. Of the remaining 6 cash buyers, it wasn't the biggest offer, but the one which came closest to allowing her to keep the pub for the 2 more years she wanted. Urban Collective paid $7.4 million and agreed to delay settlement for 18 months. A fair price, says McEwen. It translated to about $3,600 per square metre. "Not the biggest," he says, pointing to a car park off nearby Kay Road, which went for about $5.5 million, or $6,000 per square metre, but Maureen was happy. McEwen says she just knew the business didn't work anymore. "It's just what happens when the city pushes out. Other places will go too." Knowing the gap it leaves with a 550 capacity, it was the only real mid-size venue in Auckland. John Baker wished New Zealand was like Sweden or Japan, where a purpose-built music space might be built into the development. Developer McEwen, who understands the structures of modern noise regulations, says that would be impossible, but the new building has provision for a cafe bar. The King's Arms building, sitting on wooden piles, could be moved. The council had no heritage designations on it. The developers would be happy to see it taken away by someone. "Everyone's an idealist," says McEwen, but no one has put their hand up. So sometime between April and October, the pub would be bold, ready for next year's earthworks season. The apartments would be ready in early 2020. Half pre-sold, 2 to members of the Gordon clan. Maureen planned to buy a third before she passed away. Maria Sheridan can't think of anything worse. She doesn't want to come back here once it's gone. On October 13, 2017, Maureen Gordon passed away. The funeral at St. Michael's Catholic Church in Remuera was packed. So was a wake, which lasted late into the night in the music bar at the King's Arms. Tim Weary was among the many to speak. "The place is coming down, but the memories will still remain," he told the assembled. A few weeks before the end, Maria ran out of patience with the thefts. 4 burly men went up ladders, took down every remaining sign from the pub's exterior, and stashed them in that already crowded office. They left only an electric lion red sports bar sign that looked as if it might give you a bit of a shock if you tried to nick it. The Auckland Library has archived 3 decades of gig posters. The National Library has photographed the place inside and out. There's a souvenir King's Arms t-shirt on sale. Brendan planned the last quiz, a 50-team extravaganza and a cab home. "I think I'll be drunk for the first time at a quiz," he said. Lisa scheduled the final weekend of music. Local favourites Jordan Luck, Alum NOP and of course Al Hunter, flying up for the occasion from Westport. She was underwriting this one herself and so a touch worried. Peter had planned the last night of all. They'd stay open till 4 a.m. or until the booze ran out, then kip upstairs in sleeping bags.
That was The King's Arms on The Long Read from Stuff, written by Steve Kilgallen, read by Elmo Johnston and produced by Jen Black. This episode was edited by Connor Scott. If you listen via our website, you can hear this story and more like it on The Long Read podcast, available on all the usual platforms. If you follow the podcast, you'll get the latest episode automatically. Thanks for listening.
This pod took time and resources to produce. Please support our mahi and visit stuff.co.nz/support.